Pardon me, a little housekeeping here at the beginning. Testing one, testing two. Dan Galante, how does that sound? Kind of warm? Should I be closer to the mic? Should I be farther? Do I need to turn it up, turn it down? We're in the shake. A little closer, okay. We're in the shakedown cruise of a new home studio. Been working on this for a while, so throughout the night, actually, you may be hearing adjustments being made done live. Pardon the pulling back of the curtain a little bit, but I think we'll get it worked out before the end of the evening. In for George Norrie tonight. This is Ian Punnett. I was listening to a little bit of the broadcast last night with John B. Wells. Am I the only one who thinks that he sounds like a cross between Art Bell and Isaac Hayes? He's got this very cool sort of Isaac Hayes quality to his voice. And it's like John James Earl Bell or something. I don't know. There's just this neat combo about it. But thanks again to George for giving me an extra night here tonight as he uses up the end of the year vacation time so he doesn't lose it. Looking forward to this weekend, too. Great show tonight. We'll do open lines later. Get back to that coming up. Also coming up next night, tomorrow night, Gary Patterson on Coast to Coast AM. More rock and roll mysteries. Plus, he's got a special guest, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that later on this hour. It is it's an honor to work out all of the details. I want to say thank you and a shout out to all of the technical folks at Premier Radio Networks who've done a fabulous job in trying to get this studio both online and then also fully equipped so that we have finally, as many of you have been asking for I don't know, 9 years, 8 years, however long it's been, that I would have email and fast blast capabilities live on the air. So now that I'm in this new studio, we'll have that, and not tonight. And that's not the technical guy's fault. That's on my end, but I'm working on it. So maybe by this time next week, we'll have that up and running. And I will just say right now, it is unusual to not have to drive breathlessly to get to a studio to do Coast to Coast. And I will be, probably dressed a little more casually than I ordinarily have been. But you don't have to think of it that way. I'm not in my pajamas. Yes, I am. I'm wearing a tuxedo. I'm wearing a black and white tuxedo for this shakedown cruise of Coast to Coast AM, wearing my pajamas. And I have a plaid cummerbund on, just like my pajamas. So just think of it that way, wearing the tuxedo. And no, I'm kidding. I'm not wearing pajamas. I'm wearing my wife's pajamas. No, I'm not. Coming up tonight, we'll get to open lines next hour. And then before that, we'll do some crypto news not to be missed. Medical myths, space collisions, and the end of the world as we know it. Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, in for George Norrie, this is Ian Punnett. We'll get to Alan Weissman coming up in just a second, a guy who's been on the bean a little bit over the last couple of weeks, and I'll talk to him about his book, The World Without Us, a little bit later on this hour. It's a fascinating book. I read it, I don't know, about a month and a half ago or so. I didn't know if I'd ever have a chance to have him on Coast to Coast. And then I saw the movie I Am Legend last weekend, which obviously raked in huge money at the box office. And I kept thinking about that movie through the lens of the book of Alan Weissman. So I want to talk about some of the issues he brings up in his book about the end of the world as we know it. And I'll get to that coming up in just a second. First, if you've been to coasttocoastam.com tonight, you already know the story from the Los Angeles Times. An asteroid similar to the one that flattened forests in Siberia in 1908 could plow into Mars next month. JPL scientists put the chances that it will hit the red planet on January 30th at about 1 in 75. That's 1 in 75 for a collision with Mars. A 1 in 75 shot is wildly unusual, says an astronomer with the Near Earth Object Office, which routinely tracks about 5,000 near Earth objects in the neighborhood. We're used to dealing with odds like 1 in a million, he said. Something with a 1 in 100 chance makes us sit up straight in our chairs. The impact would probably send dust into the atmosphere, scientists said. Depending on where the asteroid hit, such a plume might even be visible from telescopes on Earth. The Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is mapping the planet, would have a front row seat, and NASA's two JPL-built rovers, Opportunity and Spirit, might be able to take pictures from the ground. How cool is that? I would pay $19.95 for pay-per-view for that. How about you? Also, by the way, from physorg.com, NASA announced the next mission in the Mars Scout program, originally planned for launch in 2011, though, has been pushed back to 2013. Also at physorg.com, which is a great site for science stories, researchers in the United States selected seven medical beliefs espoused by both physicians and members of the general public for critical review. They then searched for evidence to support or refute each of these claims. Now, these are scientists, too. These are medical doctors who are espousing these beliefs. The results show that the seven most commonly held medical beliefs range from unproven to flat-out untrue. Now, think about that in context of the conversations we have on Coast to Coast. I mean, these are things which a doctor, after many years of med school and lots of, you know, fancy book learning after that, would still believe to be true, only to find out later on that it's not. For example, they found no evidence supporting the need to drink 8 glasses of water a day. In fact, studies suggest that adequate fluid intake is often met by the consumption of juice, milk, and even coffee. Clinical evidence also points to the dangers of drinking excessive amounts of water. Does shaving your hair cause it to grow back faster or coarser? No. Does reading in dim light ruin your eyesight? No. The belief that we only use 10% of our brains? Refuted by studies of patients with brain damage. The belief that hair and fingernails continue to grow after death may be an optical illusion caused by the retraction of skin after death. Finally, there's no evidence to support beliefs such as banning mobile phones from hospitals on the basis of electromagnetic interference, or that if you keep doing it, it'll get stuck that way. That, you know, I don't know if you saw the piece John Stossel did on the interference on planes, wasn't it? Or was it on CNN? I don't know. It was a fascinating thing. Absolutely unproven that a cell phone could have any interference on a plane, and they know it, and they just keep doing it. Anyway, it's still possible to live long and prosper, though, and there's a story from the Associated Press tonight about the last World War I veteran in Ohio who just died. That leaves only two World War I veterans left alive in the United States. J. Russell Coffey died Thursday at the age of 109. God bless him. Mr. Coffey drove his car until he was 104 years old and had had his left turn signal on since he was 93. Now, I'm kidding about that last part, but that's pretty amazing. In fact, I heard an interesting story about World War II and Korean War veterans this morning. I think I'll relate that coming up tomorrow on Coast to Coast AM, some opening remarks about a famous Christmas voyage. From Weird Asia News, an amazing love story has come out of China recently and managed to touch the world. Have you heard about this? I got this from FARC.com. Over 50 years ago, Lou was a 19-year-old guy that fell in love with a 29-year-old widowed mother named Zhu. Now, at the time, it was unacceptable and immoral for a younger man to love an older woman. So to avoid trouble, Lou and Zhu decided to elope and live in a cave. In the beginning, they had nothing, no electricity or even food. They ate grass and roots they found in the mountain. Lou made a kerosene lamp that they used to lighten up their lives. Starting the second year of living in the mountain, however, Lou, again, this 19, 20-year-old guy, began, and then continuously for about 50 years, to hand-carve the steps down the mountain so that his wife could get down easily. When he was done, he had hand-carved 6,000 steps down the mountain. Recently, 72 years old, The guy died from farm work and collapsed, and the story is now making international news. Carved 6,000 steps by hand down a mountainside. You can find out more on my blog. I'll put that up a little bit later on this hour. And I'll include the remarks that she keeps making as she strokes the casket for this guy. That's something about that story I found very touching. 6,000 steps. I think the most I've ever done is shovel 3 steps for my wife of snow. I think that's the most I've ever done to prove my love. And actually, I haven't even done that. I ordered my teenage boys to do it. It's not exactly the same. Got lots of email. I'll share it coming up tomorrow night. But I did get one I'll pass along to you that it's the 21st today, supposedly 5 years until the end of the Mayan calendar. Are we in the countdown? I guess we are in the countdown, the 5-year countdown. Amazing to think about it. Don't know what it means yet, of course. There's lots of different opinions of that on Coast to Coast AM, but it does make you think a little bit about the movie I Am Legend. That's what I thought it was. I thought it was, not the best science fiction movie ever, but I enjoy Will Smith. But what I found fascinating was the depiction of Manhattan gone feral. The idea that there was one guy left, or, supposedly one person left on the planet. And what would happen to the Earth if we were all gone? How long would it take for it to return to its original wild roots? That is the subject of the book, The World Without Us. Alan Weissman joins us, and I'm grateful because I understand you just got back from China. Is that right?
I did. Not only did I just come back from China, but I came back to about 3 feet of snow in my home in Massachusetts, so I understand what you mean about shoveling, because it took me a half an hour of that to get into the front door.
Well, I totally get that, and I love the book you wrote. Are you researching something else that brought you to China?
No, I was on book tour. The book has been published in nearly 30 languages, and my Chinese publishers invited me over, and I was in the enormous cities of Shanghai, Beijing, and Guangzhou, talking to enormous crowds and having very large book signings, I'm very grateful to say. It was fascinating talking to the Chinese about this subject.
Now, you say talking to the Chinese as though you could talk Chinese. Are you affluent?
I'm fluent in Spanish. I used an interpreter in China.
Okay. and so they were very receptive to the idea of the world without us.
Well, this book has struck a chord, I think, in lots of places. I'm having a great deal of sympathetic reception across political lines and across national boundaries. And apparently everyone is very intrigued by the notion of thinking about our world in a way that kind of clears us out of our path for a bit so we can see more easily what else lives here and get a sense of, by looking at all the stuff that we would leave behind if we suddenly disappeared, exactly what impact we are having on that, right, on the world. So,
and that brought me to something in the book that you get to is there's sort of, we have to think about the world without us from a couple of different ways. If we just all disappeared tomorrow, what would happen to the world? And, or what would happen if we lived long enough to turn off all of the important things so they didn't blow up?
Well, actually, I bring that up when I look at some power plants.
Yeah.
I look at the petroleum industry. You know, what would happen to all those tanks and pipelines and, cracking stations, the stuff that you see driving through New Jersey or where I went from Houston to Galveston, and also what would happen to our nuclear plants. And it turns out that if people just suddenly disappeared and didn't bank the fires in our petroleum industry, according to inspectors of those plants, it could be a rather dramatic departure because it takes constant human vigilance to keep that stuff from blowing up. And if nobody were there manning the computers, manning the safety mechanisms, that could really be a mess and put a pretty sooty cloud into the atmosphere for a long time until everything that was around there burned up.
Well, and that's what I mean. It's sort of like two different, in a way, there's sort of like two different futures. I mean, we can look at it, I'm sure, in varying degrees in other ways as well, and I look forward to talking about that with you. But I found that that thought first worthy of exploration, that that if there were Perugia, right, if we all just disappeared and nobody could turn anything off, then what would happen with the nuclear power plants, and how long would it take for the nuclear plants to explode, and for these petroleum plants and these other power plants to go catastrophic, and what would that mean to the environment?
It's hard to say how long it would take for the power the petroleum fired or the coal-fired plants or the refineries to go catastrophic. Some of them would just kind of gunk up. Others just might catch fire, and then that fire might cause a chain reaction that would jump the fail-safe mechanisms that they have now that keep accidents from going from neighboring plant to neighboring plant. I couldn't get anyone to speculate on exactly when that might happen. The stuff could just lurk around for a while, slowly burning, until suddenly a flare ignited something that, you know, you've got fluids that are constantly going through pipelines, and eventually something will corrode. That might take 20 years, and when that thing corroded, that might be when an explosion took place. So that's hard to say. The nuclear plants are very easy, though, because nearly all of our nuclear plants, and there's 440-some in the world, and most of them have multiple reactors, nearly all of them are water-cooled. And something has to keep that water circulating around the reactor core all the time. Now, that's usually the power plant itself, but I went to Palo Verde, which is the newest one that we have in the United States. It's outside of Phoenix. And I was told that if the 2,000 people who manned that thing suddenly disappeared, automatically the plant would shut off. It is programmed to do that. I said, but what would keep the water circulating? And they say, well, emergency generators would automatically come online. What powers them? Diesel. How much you got? 7-day supply.
Oh.
And that's pretty much the norm. So what would
7-day supply.
After 7 days, the water would just be standing there. It would be stagnant. The heat from the reactor would continue to evaporate it. And within a week or two, and sometimes, you know, much faster, it happened much faster at Three Mile Island, enough would evaporate that the reactor core would be exposed. And depending on how much fuel is in it, depending where it is in its fueling cycle, it will either burst into flames, and those flames would be very smoky and radioactive, like the flames when, you know, when Chernobyl burned, or it would melt down. And also Chernobyl, in fact, melted down as well. So that would happen at all of our plants, and that would be a mess. I mean, you know, for this book, I also go to Chernobyl, and, you know, at Chernobyl, I saw some really interesting things, because after the disaster, within a year or so, a lot of things were, living things were invading the space that had been abandoned by humans and were starting to grow again. And some of them are growing rather oddly. I mean, I saw pine trees with runs of needles of different lengths, and there's definite genetic damage. But some of the studies now that are taking place on animals are showing something really interesting. There's a population of voles there, you know, small rodents. And even though they are dying early, as are apparently other animals as well, they've done some studies on some of the birds, like swallows that I saw nesting around the reactor, even though the voles are dying early, they're also sexually maturing early, and they're having bigger broods, which seems to be nature's way of responding to some dramatic change in the environment, in this case elevated radiation, by just throwing out more possibilities there that something will either mutate or a recessive gene will express itself that will allow something to have more radiation tolerance. And those more radiation-resistant ones will be the fittest who will survive, and that will be the way that evolution will proceed in that new direction. Of course, it's possible that some species can't tolerate it at all, and their reign right. in a radioactive environment will be over. If 440 nuclear plants go like Chernobyl did, it's hard to say how much stuff would be fatally impacted all over the earth, but I suspect a lot.
I want you to hang on to that thought because I'm not done with it yet. And I want to pick at that a little bit before we get into another way of looking at the world without us. And I'll bring in an interesting story that I just read tonight, too, about recent genetic research they have done on pygmy populations. I know that sounds like it may have nothing to do with this, but it's exactly what you're talking about. And we'll get back to this subject of what would it be like? What would downtown Manhattan be like? What would Los Angeles be like? Our major cities, how long would it be before they're overrun with wildlife? Before the forest returned to our concrete jungles, coming up next, the world without us before we get to open lines on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Making sure that George gets all the time off he deserves here toward the end of the year, and I'll be doing tonight's open lines coming up a little bit later on, and then tomorrow night on Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett, we'll get back to rock and roll mysteries with Gary Patterson, and we'll talk with Gary too about this upcoming Beatles thing in England, and a couple of mysteries from the other side of the Atlantic. I think you'll find interesting. Gary's always up to the latest research, and I think he's going to be feeling pretty good because his semester of teaching is over. He must be on his Christmas break, so he's going to stay up with us coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast AM. Back to the conversation about the world without us. It's Alan Weissman's book about what would happen to the world. What should we think about if we weren't here? What would the world be like if we were gone? And there's lots of different ways to think about the approach and how the way we go into that future would determine what that future might look like. We're still exploring the idea of simultaneous nuclear power plants exploding virtually around the world and what that would mean then to the future of various species. I want to talk to him a little bit more about his trip to Chernobyl, some of the other things he learned in Europe, and then I got to ask him about lions in Manhattan. What I saw in I Am Legend last weekend at the box office. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Alan Weissman joining us before we get to open lines eventually on Coast to Coast AM, in for George Norrie. This is Ian Punnett, and Alan and I were just talking about that these nuclear power plants around the world have a life expectancy if we just all disappeared as humans. And it's, let me ask you, as you went around, you both in Chernobyl, in China for that matter, do they do better than we do in terms of a preparation for how long those plants could exist without human assistance?
I didn't visit any nuclear plants in China, so I don't know. But frankly, there really aren't that many kinds of operational nuclear plants in the world. There are a couple pebble bed reactors out there that don't use water cooling system, but you know, here's a bottom line. Everything that I saw from, you know, just the functioning of cities, you know, like the subways underneath New York, to lots of our infrastructure, highways and bridges, to our power plants, to simply the houses that we live in, it's amazing how even though some of this stuff looks so durable and so completely indestructible, such as, you know, enormous steel bridges, it all depends on human maintenance and constant human maintenance. And if you remove human beings from the picture, the stuff's going to start to crumble really fast. In fact, the stuff that's going to last the longest on Earth is some of the first stuff that we ever made. You know, when we were making houses and buildings out of stone, literally the stuff that the Earth is made out of, that stuff doesn't really go back to Earth because it's already there. But our artificial materials like concrete and steel and stuff like that, they are going to start to dissolve in many different ways, which I describe in the book, if humans aren't around. And even though this was not the topic of my book, it became kind of a subtext that you begin to realize the importance of the maintenance people, the people who keep our subways pumped, the people who paint our bridges, the people who show up to work on our power plant. Our power plants, I mean, you can get rid of all the politicians and policymakers. In fact, I realized after I had interviewed hundreds of people for this book, scientists and just people on the ground from all over the world, I hadn't interviewed any policymakers because they really don't have a lot to do with with holding civilization together.
Right.
Oftentimes they're very good at tearing it apart. But you get rid of the maintenance personnel, and everything will just go to hell really, yeah, really quickly. They're the unsung heroes of our society, no question.
And you look at the 35W bridge collapse in the Twin Cities.
I know, that's my hometown. I had been over that thing many times. And that's a really excellent example, because in my book I show why New York's bridges are so durable. They were built way before we had computers that would calculate the minimum tolerances that we needed to have a bridge stand and take a certain amount of traffic. And that's a case of doing things as economically as possible. You know, I have an anecdote in the book. Colonel John Glenn, Wernher von Braun used to tell this story. He's in the nose cone waiting to be shot into space as the first American to orbit the Earth, and he realizes seconds before liftoff, says, "Oh, Lord, I'm sitting on a pile of low bids." Well, back in the days when New York built its bridges, you know, they just heaped on mass because they couldn't make those kinds of finite, really, really tight calculations. But now we make the lowest bids. So that means the lowest, the fewest materials that we need to make a bridge stand up. And that's how we build them. And obviously they break down really fast. That bridge over 35W was built in the 60s, and it was not built at all the way the Brooklyn Bridge was built. And, the concrete tolerances worked for a while,
right,
but all the pressure from the Mississippi River on that thing, forget it.
And 15 years early. I remember that. I mean, they had the human, a lot of good pointy head calculations about how long that bridge was supposed to last, and it came in about 15 years early.
Well, look around you. Look at everything that you see in your own house and in your cities, and you'll see we're all living in a pile of low bids.
Right.
And this stuff just is not built to last.
Well, And I don't mean to get you sidetracked, but I found that so fascinating, the idea of how fast things would break down. Because I think in our hubris, perhaps even in specifically in American hubris, but I don't know, maybe it's like this all over the world, that we think somehow that if we disappeared, our cities and towns that we left behind would stand as a kind of eternal monument to us or something, and that future civilizations would come from another planet and they would marvel at this big world that we had left behind, when in fact it may not take as long as we think for it to go back to being wild again.
Well, what they might find is Machu Picchu, though a lot of it would be overgrown because that thing is made out of rocks. But when I went to New York City, I asked the question of everybody from architects to structural engineers to botanists, what could this island possibly return to a forest the way it was when Henry Hudson first saw it? And 100% of them said it absolutely would, if there were no human beings there. And it would start under the city. I mean, Manhattan, the name derives from an old Algonquin term that means hilly. It used to be this hilly island with about 40 streams and rivers, draining it off. There was a river that drained this lake, which is where the Plaza Hotel is now, off to the East River, and there were several rivers off this broad ridge line to the west side, which today we call Broadway. All that stuff was smashed flat to superimpose the grid on the city. So a lot of those rivers are now underground, plus the normal groundwater. And the subway engineers have to keep nearly 800 pumps going a day to keep the subways from flooding. If they weren't there, or if nobody were manning the power pumps, the subways would flood within 2 or 3 days. And then all those steel columns that are holding up the streets would start to corrode, and within 20 years they would start to collapse, and then the streets above them would cave in, and pretty soon we'd have rivers on the surface. That 4, 5, 6 line down Lexington Avenue would become the Lexington River. and then fish and mollusks would be dropped in there by passing birds, and it's amazing. I mean, one thing that I found, no matter how contaminated a place I went to, like Chernobyl, or I went to the place where we used to make nerve gas outside of Denver, which was once considered the most contaminated place in the world. Anytime human beings abandon something, no matter how sterile it seems, nature will find something that will live there and life will start to flourish again. I mean, the power of life is totally awesome. I found that repeatedly in this book. And life would start coming up through the cracks. And just imagine New York without any people raking leaves. I mean, first of all, the sewers would all clog because plastic bags would clog them up. Leaf litter and branches would start filling up the gutters, seeds would start germinating in them, and then with no firemen, within a few years, fire would break out, and fire would jump to buildings, so then the insulation in buildings and paper inside buildings would add carbon to this new growing soil cap that would be covering the streets. Plants would be putting roots right down through the streets. I saw this in an abandoned village in Cyprus that got kind of orphaned during the Cyprus Civil War in the 70s.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating. I thought that particular, are you talking about the resort village they
exactly.
built?
Exactly. It was a seaside resort that had been built, you know, new high-rise hotels with balconies over the ocean facing east towards Syria and Israel. And then Civil War broke out. It was Greek Cypriot money, but it ended up after the truce on the Turkish side of the line. And the Turkish Cypriots, very cleverly, didn't let people go in there and invade it. They put a barbed wire fence around it, figuring that this valuable real estate would be a great bargaining chip once the island got around to reunification talks. Well, sadly, 33 years have passed, and that hasn't happened. But in the meantime, no people have gone in there, but nature has. And the buildings are just basically wrecks. They're mostly still standing, but they're falling apart. Trees are growing through the rooftops. Ornamental foliage has taken them over. Animals live in all the rooms. Sand dunes, you know, fill the hotel lobbies. The only thing that looks good and is being still used is the beach, but it's not being used by human beings. It's being used by all these sea turtles that aren't being bothered anymore. So it's a great place if you're a Mediterranean sea turtle. And none of those buildings are salvageable now. They would have to bulldoze them and start all over. So that's what happens to new architecture if it's not maintained. A leak in the roof will just start creating havoc inside.
Well, I'm going to push back a little bit and say I was thinking of your book while I'm watching this movie, I Am Legend. And I thought, okay, when I saw the vegetation in all the cracks in all the asphalt after all of the people of the world are gone except for Will Smith and a dog.
Yeah, I saw the movie myself. And I think, you know, they got the cracks, the plants growing out of the cracks. Right. They have kind of a small meadow growing in Times Square. I think that's a little bit premature to have all that knee-high grass there. But, you know.
Okay. Well, no, so I'll go along with you in this. But I thought it was interesting because I kept thinking about your work when I was watching that movie. And so I saw the elk running through downtown Manhattan. I thought, okay. Possible. I saw the lion going after the elk, and I thought, okay, that, I mean, it, assuming that all the people disappeared, it didn't mean that the animals would just all naturally die at the zoo. They just might get so desperate that they find a way to escape, or one out of 10 of them escapes, or however nature finds a way to go on, and they might find a way to live in Manhattan.
Well, that pair of lions, I mean, it's not stated in the movie, but it's obviously zoo escapees. And I had some questions about that. I mean, how did they unlock their cage? But right. I will grant you, you know, it's possible that something could have happened. Deer, I don't know if elk would make it all the way to Manhattan that fast, but there certainly would be deer crossing the bridges because the bridges will stay up for a century or two before rust starts to pop the rivets. You know, rust will expand. It takes up a lot more space than steel. So there'll definitely be deer. I think that the deer would be hanging out in the parks more than they would be running down through lines of abandoned cars the way they had it in the movie. But definitely there will be deer. I mean, already coyotes and wild turkeys are showing up in Manhattan. So
are they really? Okay, lots of that. Well, let's talk about that a little bit more, about the wildlife that would return and what would happen to wildlife populations in a world without us.
Sure. Well, for one thing, our domestic animals wouldn't do too well because cattle used to be a wild species in Africa, and then it was domesticated, and it's been kind of, through selection, turned into this big digestion machine, you know, that gets really fat. And the cattle that we have now in the world, they require pastoralists in Africa where they come from, or cowboys here in the Americas, or they sit around feedlots. and they will be just sitting ducks for predators. Bobcats, wolves, coyotes, they're going to do very, very well. They're going to have a big feast, and those things are going to be gone, but that's going to create space for the buffalo to return and to fill the prairies. And so buffalo will do real well. Our pet dogs, I think, will get out-competed by coyotes and wolves. Some of them might interbreed with them. But cats, very interestingly, our house cats are identical to a wild species that exists around the Mediterranean rim. It's very furtive. You rarely see it in the wild, but they're there. And our house cats, when they colonists brought them to the Americas in the 17th century, they immediately adapted to this birdsong-sized niche. And they really haven't been domesticated. I mean, they just sort of consider us to be an easy part of the ecosystem, or, you know, this two-legged thing that brings them free food and gives them shelter. But you feed a cat a meal and then put it outside, it'll immediately start hunting again. I mean, it hunts for pleasure, and these cats are here to stay. They're going to be part of the North American ecosystem for a long time to come.
I think that's very interesting. And how that might then also change. We would go back to being, we would have a wild future in the world without us, but it would be a different wild future than the one before us.
Absolutely. I mean, human beings, unfortunately, have grown so numerous and so powerful that we are eliminating a lot of other species on Earth. I mean, since I mentioned songbirds, it's pretty well documented. I mean, and you don't have to be a scientist. Everybody notices it now that we just have a lot fewer birds around. We don't hear as much bird song. The forests are quiet, and that's because we have been mowing down, among other reasons, so many forests in the tropics, in Indonesia, and in Africa, and in Central America, and Mexico, and Northern South America, where birds that migrate have to pass through in their migration, and they don't have any place to land. There's not enough habitat for them. In the wintertime, oftentimes, because, you know, we're mowing down native forest and planting more coffee bushes or whatever, and we're using a lot of pesticides that birds don't do well with. So you take human beings out of the equation, and those surviving birds will do really well because trees will start to come back very quickly. I show in my book how they will recolonize fields awfully quickly, even fields that have been badly pesticided, because some trees are more acid tolerant, so they'll take those soils that have been treated with a lot of nitrogen, and that will create just a lot more bird life. So we'll have an explosion of that, and they will come more in balance with the house cats that are now right now, you know, polishing off an awful lot of them. So there's right. Lots of examples like that of how our absence would create some great opportunities for a lot of wild species.
Okay, so I'm going to go with me on the Darwin theory, okay? You mentioned evolution earlier. So what would happen, do you think, to apes again, given the ability that they would be at near or, you know, at the top, closer to the top of the food chain where they are, and or what other species would end up at the top of the food chain in a world without us? And how long might it take before we saw anything close to, like, apes wearing pants and driving cars again?
Well, you know, there's some question as to whether they really ever would. I mean, according to people who, you know, who have traced evolution, paleontologists who, you know, who really believe in it, they believe that there is a certain point where we and chimpanzees descended from the same common ancestor. And so I was curious, you know, like, why did the chimpanzees stay in the forest, and why did we leave and go off to the savannas? You know, we think of ourselves, or we like to think of ourselves as this risk-taking creature with a vision that wanted to see beyond the horizon and try new things. But I think what really happened is that when this split took place, it was about, 7-8 million years ago. There were lots of ice ages going on in the world then, and there's so much moisture was locked up in the ice that Africa was going through droughts. So forests were shrinking, and there was probably a battle royal over the more limited resources in the forest. So it may be that the chimpanzees were actually the winners, and we were the losers that got booted out, and we literally had to learn how to stand on our own two feet. And luckily, you know, a lot of A lot of them died, but luckily our ancestors were the fittest of all and the shrewdest of all, and they managed to somehow learn to evade lions, and here we are today. But you know, I did consider this question because I knew a lot of readers would think about it. And
Wait, Alan, I got to ask you because I want to hear that. I want to hear the answer to that question, and yet I know you had originally only agreed to give us this amount of time. Could I implore you to give us another 15, 20 minutes after the top of the hour?
Sure thing. That'll be
okay. All right, then I'll do that, and I'd love to hear the rest of where you're going with that. And I want to ask Alan Weissman a question about what the world would be like without most of us. What if 10% of the human population survived into the future? We'll talk about that. Plus, we'll give all the numbers that you need to join the conversation. Coming up next, Alan Weissman, The World Without Us, in for George Norrie, who I hope is enjoying another excellent extended weekend. This is Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast AM.